From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, actor and comic Dennis Leary. This Sunday, he gets roasted on Comedy Central. He's also starring in the new film, The Secret Lives of Dentists. Later on in the show, we'll hear a review of the movie from critic David Edelstein. There's a new special edition DVD of Casablanca. We'll feature an interview with Al Jean Harmetz, who wrote the book Round Up the Usual Suspects, about the making of the movie. And we hear from Leslie Epstein, whose father and uncle wrote the screenplay. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. The news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. According to attorneys representing hundreds of alleged victims of clergy sexual abuse, the Boston Archdiocese has offered to pay $55 million to settle the lawsuits. NPR's Anthony Brooks reports.
If approved by the plaintiffs, the $55 million would represent by far the largest deal to settle allegations of clergy sex abuse since the scandal erupted a year and a half ago. It would resolve claims by more than 500 men and women who said they were sexually abused as children by Boston priests, while senior church officials ignored the complaints or shuffled known pedophiles from parish to parish. Attorneys for the plaintiffs say the offer is concrete and substantive and represents a hopeful sign, but they say much negotiation remains ahead. They also say it reflects good faith on the part of Sean O'Malley, who was just installed as Boston's new archbishop last week. O'Malley came to Boston with a track record of settling clergy abuse scandals in Palm Beach, Florida, and Fall River, Massachusetts, where he served as bishop. But with more than 500 victims and 35 attorneys, Boston represents by far his biggest challenge. Anthony Brooks, NPR News.
In New York, federal authorities have charged a man with providing support to Al-Qaeda. NPR's Larry Abramson reports.
Uzair Paracha is a citizen of Pakistan who's been held as a material witness for months now. The charges filed against him allege that Paracha met with someone identified as an Al-Qaeda associate in Pakistan. The associate allegedly asked Paracha to obtain immigration documents so the Al-Qaeda member could travel to the U.S. and remain here. The government says the man also asked Paracha to pose as the associate in order to help him obtain those documents. The associate never came to the United States, the government says, but Paracha agreed to move money into the associate's account and take other actions so it would appear that the Al-Qaeda member was in fact here. Paracha could face a maximum of 15 years in prison if convicted on all counts. Larry Abramson, NPR News.
Israeli artillery and fighter planes struck Hezbollah positions in southern Lebanon today after Hezbollah fired at Israeli positions along the northern border. NPR's Linda Gradstein reports.
An Israeli army spokesman said there was massive Hezbollah fire, including anti-tank missiles, light weapons fire, and mortars at several Israeli army posts along the northern border. Israeli media said two Hezbollah shells hit towns on the Israeli-occupied Golan Heights. Israeli planes struck back at Hezbollah targets in southern Lebanon. There were no immediate reports of casualties. There have been increased tensions between Israel and Hezbollah since last week, when a Hezbollah official was killed by a bomb in his car in Beirut. Hezbollah blamed Israel for that attack and vowed revenge. Linda Gradstein, NPR News, Jerusalem.
The Dow gained 64 points to close at 91.91. The Nasdaq lost 8 to close at 16.44. This is NPR News. Negotiators for Verizon Communications and its two unions are taking a break from contract negotiations. The break was called by federal mediators who've been overseeing the talks, which involve nearly 80,000 Verizon phone company workers who've been working without a contract since August the 2nd. The spiritual leader of the Anglican Communion has called senior clergy to an urgent meeting in London to discuss this week's confirmation of Reverend Gene Robinson, an openly gay Episcopalian bishop in the United States, Suzanne Chislett reports.
The more conservative branches of the Anglican Church have already warned the confirmation of its first openly gay bishop could lead to divisions. Leaders from Asia and Africa said Robinson's appointment was contrary to the Christian tradition and said it went against the teachings of the Bible. The Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, is summoning delegates to a meeting in London in the hope that any permanent damage can be avoided. He's already warned that branches of the faith should not make local decisions which will constrain the church elsewhere. Now he admits anxieties have reached the point where church officials need to sit down and discuss the consequences of Robinson's confirmation. A statement issued by the Archbishop urges followers to preserve respect for one another and their common bonds when they meet in the British capital in October. For NPR News, I'm Suzanne Chislett in London.
Former baseball commissioner Peter Uberoth says he's running for California governor in the October 7th recall election. Uberoth, who also organized the 1984 Summer Olympics in Los Angeles, pledged to serve only the remainder of Governor Gray Davis's term if Davis is recalled. Uberoth joins fellow Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger, who announced his candidacy yesterday. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
The NPR Shop introduces All Songs Considered 3, the newest compilation of music heard on All Things Considered at npr.org.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. This Sunday on Comedy Central, Dennis Leary will be roasted by friends and colleagues. Once known for his acid-tongued, chain-smoking stand-up routine, Leary is now better known for his acid-tongued, chain-smoking movie roles. His films include The Ref, Wag the Dog, and The Thomas Crown Affair. Leary's also starring in the new film The Secret Lives of Dentists. It follows the marriage of dentist David Hurst, played by Campbell Scott, and Dana Hurst, played by Hope Davis. At the beginning of the film, Leary plays one of David's worst patients, a belligerent trumpet player with bad teeth. As David becomes more and more suspicious of his wife's affair, Leary's character becomes an imagined representation of David's crudest impulses. This imaginary character follows David around, trying to goad him into confronting his wife. Here, Leary makes his first appearance as David's alter ego.
Dave, let me explain something to you, okay? People hate you. You're a dentist.
Is that right?
Yes, they can't wait to get out of your office, okay? They think about you, they think pain, all right? They would like nothing more in the world than to never have to see you again, all right? And your best work never even sees the light of day.
Well, you're gonna lose every tooth in your mouth, my friend. You've got one of the worst cases of gum disease I've ever seen. So you can forget about your lousy little embouchure.
Terry spoke with Dennis Leary last year.
Most of us knew you first as a stand-up comic through your show No Cure for Cancer and from your MTV stand-up spots. Had you intended originally to act or to do comedy?
I went to school to become an actor and a writer. And then, you know, once I graduated, I went to Emerson College up in Boston. Once I graduated, you know, it's pretty obvious. I think it's probably the same way now. There's not a lot of work for actors and writers. And then Stephen Wright, the comedian who went to school with me at Emerson, had started doing stand-up, which was extraordinary because he was one of the most shy, painfully shy human beings on the planet. And I went and I saw those guys and I thought, well, if they can do it, I can do it, you know? And of course I tried and failed desperately and I spent another 3 or 4 years trying to get acting work. And then finally I just said, I'm just going to try this thing because I'll have some stage time, you know? So by the time I hit, it was hard to convince people, no, I can act. I've got a background in acting, and that was my the first part of my career. I mean, I can remember even after we got, after we did The Ref, we got some great reviews, but we also got a lot of, you know, knee-jerk critics who were astounded that, you know, this MTV stand-up comedian had been paired with the great theatrical actor Kevin Spacey and the Oscar-nominated Judy Davis, because that's... They have to pigeonhole you somehow, you know?
I want to talk about your persona in your stand-up act. In No Cure for Cancer, and in your MTV spots, I mean, you were this really, like, loud, in-your-face, you know, often obnoxious personality. let me play a little clip from No Cure for Cancer.
We live in a country where John Lennon takes 6 bullets in the chest, Yoko Ono was standing right next to him, not one bullet. Explain that to me. Explain it to me, God. Explain it to me, God. I want it explained to me now. Jesus. Now we got 25 more years. Yeah, I'm real f***ing happy now, God. I'm wearing a huge happy hat. Jesus Christ! I mean, Steve Ray Vaughan is dead, and we can't get John Bon Jovi in a helicopter. Come on, folks. Get on that helicopter, John. Shut the f*** up and get on that helicopter. There's a hairdresser in there. Yeah, go ahead in there. Yeah, yeah. I don't get it. You know, I just don't get it. I missed the point someplace. The boat left and I wasn't on the boat. Explain it to me. Heavy metal bands on trial because kids commit suicide. What is that about? Judas Priest on trial because my kid bought the record and he listened to the lyrics and he got into straight. Well, that's great. That sets a legal precedent. Does that mean I can sue Dan Fogelberg for making me into a pussy in the mid-70s? Is that possible? Huh?
Dennis Leary, can you talk about the persona you created for the stand-up act and how, if at all, that coincides with who you were at the time?
Well, I do, for stage, both with No Cure for Cancer and my last one-man show, which was Lock and Load, I create the material from bullet points of ideas that I have written down in a notebook, and I have to get up on stage and sort of improv and talk them out loud over and over again. And then from there, after a couple of months of doing it, I start to create what is, I guess, a fairly scripted performance in my head, even though it's never put down on paper. So with No Cure for Cancer, because I knew I wanted to do a show that was about death in all its forms, in order to be really comfortable on stage when you're creating it, you have to feel like you're in your living room talking to your friends on a roll, so to speak. And so I ramped it up a little bit in No Cure for Cancer because the show was so full of violent, rapid-fire imagery and discussions about, you know, pop culture and death in general. I mean, Lock and Load, there's still a lot of, you know, fast-paced talking, because that's the way I talk when I get going. But it's just the way it comes out of my head, you know. And that's just, you know, it's like Chris Rock says about his, when he talks about his wife and his stand-up act, he says, you know, there's my comedy wife and then there's my real-life wife, you know. So I think you want to feel like you're in the living room talking to your friends, but at the same time, you know, I happen to be a guy who talks very fast and I get very angry about certain issues. And, you know, sometimes people who know me really well, if they're driving in the car with me and I get upset about something, it could seem to them like I was the stand-up comedy guy or the No Cure for Cancer guy, whatever you want to call it. But I'm obviously not like that all the time.
What about figuring out where the line is between, you know, something that you could say on stage and something that's in such bad taste that you wouldn't say it?
I don't think there is a line, but I think there's a line as regards certain certain events. You know, I never personally to this day found a way to make, for instance, the death of Eric Clapton's son. That never was funny to me. It still isn't funny to me. Whereas, you know, talking about, I don't know why, about John Lennon being assassinated in No Cure for Cancer, that was funny.
Did Yoko ever write to you and say, how could you have said that about me?
No, I've never actually met Yoko. I've seen her. I have friends who live in the Dakota, so I've seen her from a distance here and there. I know I've run into many people over the years that I discussed in my stand-up shows. So
and you're still alive, so it couldn't be too bad.
Well, I mean, if you don't have a sense of humor about it, you know, then I'm just going to make fun of you again. You know what I mean? That's the way. I mean, everybody's, if you're a public figure, especially, obviously you're up for grabs, you know.
In No Cure for Cancer, you tell a story about your father having a carpentry accident when you were 10, and he kind of saws off his thumb. His thumb's hanging by a thread.
Yeah.
He tapes it back onto his hand, drives himself to the hospital where it gets repaired. Did you think that that's how you were going to be, too?
No, I thought my father was some kind of a superhero, which I guess is what probably all boys think about their dads, but he was, you know, he was also that generation of men from...
What, stoic?
You know, they looked at John Wayne as sort of like their, be-all and end-all. My father was an Irish immigrant who came to this country, you know, the old cliche, in 1950 or 51 with no money in his pockets, and he came to New York and, you know, started to make his living. So it's hard for me to look at my dad and not really admire everything that he made out of his life, because he, you know, he basically, the day that one of my sisters was born, he was at work, and they called and said my mother was at the hospital going into labor, and he drove to the downtown to where the hospital was and parked at a meter and had no money. He was waiting, you know, paycheck to paycheck. And he got out of the car and he thought, well, I'm going to have to make do with a ticket here, because I can't, you know, I have no change to put into this meter. And he looked down and he was stepping on a $5 bill. And I've always remembered that story as being like evident of my dad's approach to life, which is that, you know, you have the luck of the Irish, something good will happen. You just keep moving forward, you know.
Why did he come to the country when he did?
Because then, back then, you know, and at that time, he came from a huge family, and his mother died giving birth to the last child, and all they had was the family farm, and, you know, not everybody was going to be able to make a living off of that farm. It was going to have to be given to the oldest boy. So he had to come here to make money, because there was no economic boom in those days in Ireland. And he came, and not only did he end up making a living, but he got us fed and clothed, and we all had college education. So, you know.
What kind of job did he have?
He was a mechanic.
Mm-hmm.
He was a car nut.
You went to Catholic school?
Yeah.
For all of your school year?
12 years.
Wow.
Yep, same school, same nuns, same priests.
Were you afraid of the nuns? Do you think you were any more or less afraid of the nuns than you would have been of lay teachers?
We were more afraid of the nuns than we were of the priests, except there was one priest, the headmaster, Father Reynolds, who, when you were young, you were afraid of him because he was a real tough guy. He was an ex-boxer who grew up in the neighborhood and became a priest and then the headmaster of the school. But the nuns were, to this day, you know. I have one great nun, Sister Rosemary Sullivan, who passed away last year, and she was the one who first put me into a play in high school, and she was the nun who told me about Emerson College, which, you know, saved my life, because that's where I basically learned everything I know about acting and writing. So,
did you have to get disciplined a lot, and what was the discipline?
Yeah, I was
a
terrible student, terrible.
Uh-huh. What kind of punishments were you subjected to?
The nuns used to love to hit you on the knuckles with a ruler, and it got to the point, I mean, they would just whack you in the head, you know? This is back in the days when they were allowed to hit you without being taken to court,
mm-hmm.
you know, so. But I look back on it, and I'm really glad, because that kind of repression where, you know, you're always in a situation where you're not supposed to be laughing just leads to more laughter. I mean, some of my fondest memories are my friends and my cousins and my brothers and sisters. We're just, you know, laughing because you're not supposed to, whether it was in church or school or, you know.
Were you at all religious during that period when you were in Catholic school?
Well, we were forced to be, you know, we had to go to Mass every Sunday, and then eventually you got $200 taken off your tuition if you were in the altar boys or the choir. So that was, you know, a lot of money for my parents. So I was kicked out of the altar boys and then kicked out of the choir boys. I'm kind of proud of that.
What were you kicked out for?
Altar boys for drinking the holy wine.
yeah.
Before the Mass started, just to see what it tasted like, and I was told that was a mortal sin and I was going to hell. So that at that point I was like, well, if I'm already going, I might as well just take as many people with me as I can. And then I went into the choir boys to try to get that money taken off of the tuition again, and I think I got kicked out of the choir boys because. And I'm not trying to point the finger. Somebody was smoking, and they passed me the cigarette. I never actually took a hit off the cigarette, but it was right at the moment when the choir director turned around and caught us. So,
well, I'll point out you've taken hits off of plenty of cigarettes since then.
Oh, yeah.
Comic Dennis Leary talking with Terry Gross. He's in the new film, The Secret Lives of Dentists. And this Sunday, he'll be roasted on Comedy Central. More after a break. This is Fresh Air. We'll be right back. If you're just joining us, we're featuring an interview Terry recorded with comic Dennis Leary. When we left off, Leary was talking about his time in Catholic school.
I came from a neighborhood school. You know, I walked to school every day. It was about a block and a half, two blocks from my apartment. All the kids I grew up with, we all went to school together for 12 years. We felt like we were a big gang, and we felt like, you know, we knew how to handle, like, the nuns and the priests in terms of what we had to do and what we didn't have to do to get by. But I loved it because it was, like, I grew up in a neighborhood where you could, you know, you could basically walk anywhere. And we loved playing sports, and we loved, you know, everything about our school. And we kind of knew by the time we were, you know, 14 or 15 that we weren't buying into what the what they were teaching us anymore in terms of religion. We were just getting through until we went to college, you know.
Before you developed your really kind of, like, sarcastic, loud, onstage stand-up persona, did you ever, like, sing in school versions of Broadway shows?
Well, yeah, that's what saved me, because I did that nun, Sister Rosemary, put me in when I was, I think I was 13. She forced me to be the kid in MAME, the musical. And I ended up thinking it was great because you got the afternoons off from school to rehearse, which was the reason I really liked it. And then I guess about probably 3 years later, she put me in another musical with a friend of mine who's a fireman now. And then by the time I started to realize I wasn't going to be a hockey player because, number one, I wasn't good enough, and number two, my grades were horrendous. I started to think, well, maybe I'll do this acting thing, because it was a great way to meet girls, which I discovered in high school. And I hated musicals. To this day, I'm not a guy that goes to see musicals. I thought it was always kind of strange that people just started singing out of the blue. You know, I could not get the non-reality of that out of my head. To me, a musical was like when I saw Help or Hard Day's Night, where the Beatles would be like characters, and then when it was time to play or sing, they'd walk over and pick up the instruments and start singing. You know what I mean? So, but it was a good thing because it put the bug in my ear about acting.
In No Cure for Cancer, you talk about drugs and you say, I did my share and your share.
Mm-hmm.
When was the period in your life when you were doing that?
Well, I was a teenager from 1970, well, the entire 70s, but I mean, I went to college from 75 to 79. I mean, that alone right there,
mm-hmm.
You know, growing up in that time period, especially with when punk and new wave hit, it was a completely different approach to life, I guess. But it's also part of growing up, and it's part of the rock and roll life as well, you know.
Well, what drugs most suited your personality?
Oh, God, none of them, quite frankly. The only thing I've found that suits my personality is beer, which I like. One thing I never did was, just from watching it from a fashion point of view and also from a practical point of view, I just never saw any reason to take acid or any kind of drug that would alter your mind like that. I didn't like the Grateful Dead. I didn't like the whole hippie thing, which I just missed in terms of fashion and music. And I just didn't appeal to me. So by the time, you know, the kind of music I liked kicked in, which was the Ramones and the Clash and those fashions I liked as well, I was kind of like, thank God for that.
It sounds like you were afraid if you took acid, you'd suddenly be wearing, like, paisley
bell-bottoms
or something.
Yeah, exactly. You know, wearing a beard and listening to, you know, I'll never forget the guy who was the keyboard player, and yes, Rick Wakeman, put out a live double album of him playing the organ. And my brother and his friends used to sit around and listen to it. And I was like, this is a live double album of the organ player from Yes. I mean, this is really, we've reached the breaking point here, okay? I was glad I missed that boat.
So this is what you didn't want drugs to do, to turn you into a fan of that album.
Yeah, I remember that we, in my day, what we needed drugs for was to fuel us, to keep us up so that we could dance. And,
mm-hmm.
you know, we would go to clubs to see bands and dance. So the whole, you know, sort of double live album approach to life didn't suit. This is in the era when, you know, Rick Wakeman was doing the double live album, but, you know, Elvis Costello and The Clash were writing 3-minute songs. I mean, much the same as kids growing up now. I mean, teenagers now would be, I guess, taking a lot of ecstasy. It's probably the, you know, and the music they listen to reflects that as well. So it's, you know.
When you broke into films after doing stand-up, you know, pretty early on started making films with really great actors, De Niro, yeah. Kevin Spacey, Judy Davis. Recently you were directed by Joe Mantegna,
yes.
who I think is a terrific actor. Are there things that you've learned from, you know, on the job working with great actors that go beyond what you learned when you were in school where you were really getting your chops?
Definitely. And one of the things, I met De Niro fairly early on. He had come to see No Cure for Cancer, and he was trying to develop some, younger talent through his company, Tribeca. So, he was obviously a hero of mine. I mean, one of the reasons I wanted to act was when I saw Mean Streets the first time. It was the first time I thought at the movies, wow, I know guys like that. I could do this, you know?
So what'd you ask De Niro?
Oh, I've asked him so many questions. It's over the years. It's not even. I have to.
Right.
I have to really think about that. But I mean, he's the kind of guy. He's got a big production company, and he's been at it for years. So he's a good source. As is his partner, Jane Rosenthal, is a good source of any kind of question from financing to budget to location. I mean, it's all practical stuff, you know.
Dennis Leary spoke with Terry last year. This Sunday, Comedy Central airs their roast of Dennis Leary. He's also in the new film, The Secret Lives of Dentists. We'll hear a review of the film in the second half of the show. Trombonist Grover Mitchell died earlier this week at the age of 73. He began his career in the 50s with Lionel Hampton and Duke Ellington. He joined Count Basie's band in 1962 and eventually became Basie's lead trombonist and trusted lieutenant. In 1995, he became the Count Basie Orchestra band leader. Here's the Basie Band, under Grover Mitchell's direction and featuring Mitchell on trombone. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations, by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Pink Slip, a novel about love, work, and family by Rita Cerisi, author of Remind Me Again Why I Married You. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
There's a new special edition DVD of Casablanca coming up, the making and the writing of the film. We feature interviews with Algene Harmetz, who wrote a book about the production, and with Leslie Epstein, whose father and uncle wrote the screenplay. And David Edelstein reviews The Secret Lives of Dentists. Thank you. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave in for Terry Gross. A new special edition DVD of the classic film Casablanca came out this week. The DVD features commentary by critic Roger Ebert. In 1992, Terry spoke with Al Jean Harmetz, the author of a book about the making of Casablanca called Round Up the Usual Suspects. For many years, Harmetz covered the movie industry for the New York Times. She says no other film better demonstrates America's mythological vision of itself, tough on the outside and moral within, capable of sacrifice and romance without sacrificing individualism. Humphrey Bogart as Rick never sticks his neck out for anyone until the end of the film. In that final scene, he convinces the love of his life, played by Ingrid Bergman, to leave him and go with her husband, a French resistance leader, to America.
Because you're getting on that plane.
I don't understand. What about you?
I'm staying here with him till the plane gets safely away.
No, Richard, no. What has happened to you last night?
Last night we said a great many things. You said I was to do the thinking for both of us. Well, I've done a lot of it since then. It all adds up to one thing. You're getting on that plane with Victor where you belong.
But, Richard, no, I...
Now, you've got to listen to me. You have any idea what you'd have to look forward to if you stayed here? 9 chances out of 10, we'd both wind up at a concentration camp. Isn't that true, Louis?
I'm afraid Major Strasser would insist.
You're saying this only to make me go.
I'm saying it because it's true. Inside of us, we both know you belong with Victor. You're part of his work, the thing that keeps him going. If that plane leaves the ground and you're not with him, you'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon and for the rest of your life.
But what about us?
We'll always have Paris. We didn't have, we lost it until you came to Casablanca. We got it back last night.
When I said I would never leave you.
And you never will. But I've got a job to do, too. Where I'm going, you can't follow. What I've got to do, you can't be any part of. Ilse, I'm no good at being noble, but it doesn't take much to see that the problems of three little people don't amount to a hill of beans in this crazy world. Someday you'll understand that. Now, now. He's looking at you, kid.
Al Jean Harmetz, welcome to Fresh Air. That's such a beautiful scene, and it's a very, very moving scene. It's also a scene that solved a serious problem for the screenwriters of Casablanca. What was the problem they were stuck with in the ending here?
Well, you know that one of the chief myths about Casablanca is that nobody knew what the ending was going to be until they shot it. If you think about that, that's absolutely absurd. How can you make a picture not knowing what the ending is going to be? Would Ilse go off with Paul Henreid? Would she stay behind with Humphrey Bogart? They did know that, and it was the first year of the war. There was no way that she could stay behind with her lover. She had to go off with the man who was going back to the fight. What they had a problem doing was making her decision to go off with Paul Henreid credible. And that was why the screenwriters kept writing new speeches every single day during the early part of July. That scene was shot on July 17th and July 18th, and actually Bogart got so angry at all of the new speeches. The Hill of Beans speech was written the night before. The We'll Always Have Paris speech was written the night before. That he spent much of that day sulking in his dressing room.
What were some of the alternate speeches that were written for that last scene that we never got to hear in the movie?
One of the things that happened as those speeches were being written during the second week of July, 1942, by Howard Koch, one of the three major screenwriters, was that they got both more romantic, We'll Always Have Paris, and more patriotic. It doesn't matter a hill of beans what happens to three little people. All of that was added the closer that they got to shooting that scene. But in every version of the script and in the play on which Casablanca was based, the woman goes off with her husband. In no case does she stay behind.
Now, one ending for Casablanca called for Humphrey Bogart to be arrested, but everybody felt like, well, no, Humphrey Bogart cannot be arrested at the end of the film. Why not, and how did they rewrite the ending?
The ending in which he got arrested was in the play. That was the way, in the play, he held a gun on Major Strasser, until the airplane got safely off, tossed the gun on the table, and the last line to Renault was, "It doesn't matter, Louis, you still owe me 5,000 francs." The last line in almost every version of the scripts, and there were many of them, was still the same. But it was quite obvious that we were now at war with Germany, and there was no way that the dirty Nazi could be allowed to win. Hollywood wouldn't allow that, and certainly the American public wouldn't allow it. So the ending was changed. At some one point, it was thought that maybe both Rick and Strasser, one idea, maybe both Rick and Strasser would be shot. In another version, Renault and Rick are actually playing chess, and it's obvious that Rick will be in trouble when the movie is over and probably will go to jail. But they're playing chess, and both kings are chess-mated, and the game is over just as the airplane soars overhead, and that's the end of the movie.
Algene Harmetz speaking with Terry in 1992. Her book about the making of Casablanca is Round Up the Usual Suspects. We'll hear more of their conversation after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back now to Terry's 1992 interview with Algene Harmetz.
Casablanca was made during the Second World War, and during the war there was a set of Hollywood regulations, I guess you could call it, about how to measure a movie's effect on American morale during wartime. What was the manual that was sent around?
The Office of War Information opened a Bureau of Motion Pictures in Hollywood at Hollywood and Vine, which I find just terribly amusing because that was the defining intersection during that era of Hollywood. That was what all the radio comedians used to define Hollywood as. And the manual started out with seven questions, and the first question was, will this picture help win the war? And the studios got very good at pretending that their movies had redeeming social value and would help win the war. But in actuality, the studio moguls were very patriotic, and they were very eager to make pictures that would increase American morale and to make pictures that would help win the war. And in a funny sense, they went too much the opposite way, and you ended up with a lot of pictures, dozens, I'd say hundreds of pictures that were so layered with propaganda that the movies just lay there. You had these big undigested speeches about why we were fighting the war and what it all meant. And Casablanca was extremely lucky to be made during the first summer of the war, before the Bureau of Motion Pictures opened, and before there was a great deal of pressure on Hollywood to force-feed the movies with patriotism. So though Casablanca is propaganda, every movie is propaganda for something or other, although it was propaganda, it was propaganda out of the story, out of the performances, and not out of a lot of speeches layered in.
So do you think if Casablanca had been made later in the war, it would have to have been written differently?
Absolutely. Just go compare. I suggest that you take Casablanca and rent it at your nearby video store and at the same time rent Passage to Marseille, which is Warner Brothers' attempt to remake Casablanca a couple of years later. Had almost the entire same cast, had the same director, Michael Curtiz, same producer, Hal Wallace, Humphrey Bogart, Claude Rains, Sidney Greenstreet, Peter Lorre, Helmut Dantin, didn't have Bergman. Instead, it had Michelle Morgan, who actually was one of the early choices for the role of Ilse Lund, but she wanted too much money. And the movie just lies there. There is a eulogy that's spoken over someone's grave in that movie that is almost unwatchable.
There were other ways that the war placed restrictions on the making of Casablanca. For instance, in that last scene where Ingrid Bergman and Paul Henreid are escaping on the airplane, they couldn't use a real airplane.
The war had psychological effects on Hollywood, but it also, of course, had a lot of physical effects. And that last scene was shot on the set because you just couldn't go off to airports and shoot planes flying around. There was one scene in Casablanca which was shot at a local airport, but it was the scene with a plane on the ground when Major Strasser is arriving in Casablanca. So they shot this scene at Warner Brothers. They filled the stage with fog, not to make it atmospheric, but to hide the fact that these plywood planes in the background were so phony. And the assistant director got the brilliant idea of making the mechanics on the planes midgets, and thus you would have the perspective that these planes were full height.
So they couldn't use a real plane because all the real planes were being used for the war. Why couldn't they use a real plane?
Well, I would assume there were two things. One, you weren't allowed to do location shooting during the first weeks and months of the war. The hills where Hollywood Westerns were shot had anti-aircraft batteries on them, and the Army was in charge and was not looking favorably on location shooting. And second, airplanes were just a difficult thing to get clearance for at a time when, remember, Japanese submarines had lain off the coast of California and there were great fears of air raids.
Elgin Harmitz, I want to thank you very much for talking with us.
Hey, thanks a lot, Terry.
Elgin Harmitz, author of Round Up the Usual Suspects, about the making of Casablanca. A new special edition DVD of Casablanca has just been released. Casablanca was written by the screenwriting team of identical twins Philip and Julius Epstein. Their other screenplays include Yankee Doodle Dandy, Arsenic and Old Lace, and Mr. Skeffington. Philip's son Leslie Epstein is a novelist and director of the creative writing program at Boston University. His most recent novel is San Remo Drive. Terry spoke with Leslie Epstein last month.
What are some of your memories of Casablanca? You were alive when the movie was made. You were pretty young, but do you have memories of it being made or of seeing it for the first time?
I remember seeing it for the first time because it was shown on a 16-millimeter projector in our living room. And a number of people had gathered, and I remember seeing it there. And but I did not. I have no memory. I would have been too young, perhaps, to remember 42. I was only 4 years old. But I somehow have I can see the old projector set up in the living room, and I can see it on the screen that was set up in the living room.
Did your father talk to you about what inspired him to write it, or did your uncle discuss that with you?
They had a strange attitude toward Casablanca, and I don't know if I can use their language on the air, but I'll try. Two different phrases they used. I mean, they would always be embarrassed because they had written, my uncle wrote 50 wonderful films, but it would always be Casablanca, Casablanca. And he would say, it's just the same old crap that we used in Algiers, for example. And in fact, the actual phrase they used was, it's just a lot of slick shit. But they used that. And at the same time, I know my uncle, when there was a dispute at one time when Howard Koch, who got some credit for Casablanca and shared the Academy Award, wrote a book falsely claiming more credit than he deserved. My uncle, on the one hand saying, who cares, it's just a lot of crap, went to bed for a week.
When your father and uncle wrote Casablanca, was there a message they wanted to give about the war? I mean, was it a conscious attempt to send this message out?
Well, if you give me a minute, I can give, I think, an interesting answer to that. Hollywood turned its back on all Jewish aspects of the war. I mean, after all, they were making the American dream. That dream couldn't be a Jewish dream. So the word Jew or Jewish does not appear in any film about a domestic topic during the war, through the entire war, except one. And I am proud to say it's Mr. Skeffington. Claude Rains in that film tells his daughter, "You should go live with your mother because I'm Jewish." And in fact, the American Jewish Committee and B'nai B'rith all complained, how could you bring up these divisions at a time like this when we're fighting a war? And President Roosevelt, you know, whom we all admired enormously then, he had a board that oversaw things and was very critical of that mention of domestic anti-Semitism during a time of war. In Casablanca, the words Jew and Jews and Judaism are never used. But I asked my uncle about that, and he said the word refugees is the first word in the film. Refugees are moving across to, Europe, and there's a map and a globe turning, remember, at the beginning of the film.
Right.
And he also told me that the couple who come to the gaming table at Rick's, and then who Rick arranges to have win, a story, by the way, based on something that happened to my mother at a roulette table, that couple is meant to stand for Jewish refugees. Now, they were Bulgarian in the film, and Bulgaria is one of the few countries that protected its Jews. So maybe that was a bad choice. But in my uncle's mind, it definitely was meant to refer to the plight of the Jews through refugees and through that young couple who were helped by Rick at the gaming table, at the roulette table.
No, I remember reading that a lot of the extras in Casablanca were actually refugees who had come to America. Were many of them Jewish refugees?
Yes. In fact, I think perhaps one of the greatest actors in the world, Marcel Dalio, who stars in, I think, the greatest film ever made, which is not Casablanca, but is Rules of the Game by Renoir. He also starred in maybe the second greatest film ever made, which is Grand Illusion. That's Marcel Dalio. Plays the croupier in Casablanca. So here's this great actor whom, of course, the film industry tried to help these people. They paid them $100 a week. They paid writers. Thomas Mann's brother, Heinrich, was paid $100 a week, really to be in an office and write things that everyone knew would never be made into films. But that was the good side of the industry, trying to help these people as best they can.
Wow. You know, in spite of how inspiring Casablanca turns out to be, your father was called before the House Un-American Activities Committee during the McCarthy era. And there's a scene like this in your novel. In the novel, the interrogator says, "Mr. Jack Warner indicated that you were suspect in his eyes because," and I quote, "he is always on the side of the underdog. Do you wish to respond to that or do you wish to make a statement?" Did Jack Warner actually say that about your father?
Yes, he did. Jack Warner named my father and uncle as subversives, and they received a letter from Rankin, the head of the House Un-American Activities Committee. And the letter said, it was a two-part questionnaire. The first part said, "Have you ever been a member of a subversive organization?" And the second part said, "If so, name that organization." And my father and uncle filled out the questionnaire for the HUAC. "Have you ever been a member of a subversive organization?" They said, "Yes." "Name that organization." They put down Warner Brothers. Now, in real life, they never heard. The committee knew who they were up against, and they never heard from the committee again. In the novel, however, as you know, I expanded that scene and had them turn the tables on the committee in ways that are that I essentially made up, though there were people who bravely did that kind of thing before the committee.
You know that recent story that was recent news revelation that UAC basically, tell me if I have this wrong, that UAC basically declined to publicly interrogate certain people who they thought would be too clever and too witty for
yes,
the UAC interrogators. Do you think your father was in that category?
Well, I think it was actually Joe McCarthy, you know, who browbeat the easy guys and who stayed away from the tough ones. And I think that HUAC had the same reaction to my father and uncle. They knew they were not going to be intimidated from that questionnaire. And, you know, it is true that Jack Warner said, "Well, why did you name the Epstein boys," as everyone always called them? And he said, ah, they're always on the side of the underdog, as if that were somehow un-American.
Yeah, that's supposed to be part of the whole American thing, fighting for the underdog.
And you certainly see it in films, and you certainly see it in a film like Casablanca.
Novelist Leslie Epstein. His new book is San Remo Drive. Coming up, The Secret Lives of Dentists. This is Fresh Air. Director Alan Rudolph is best known for stylish, free-floating ensemble mood pieces in the manner of his mentor, Robert Altman. But he hasn't had much critical or commercial success in the last decade with movies like Trixie, Breakfast of Champions, and Afterglow. Now he's teamed up with playwright Craig Lucas for The Secret Lives of Dentists, based on the story by Jane Smiley. Film critic David Edelstein says it's a good match.
Jane Smiley's novella, The Age of Grief, is a melancholy meditation on loss in which almost nothing happens, at least nothing that the narrator can see. His name is David Hurst, or Dr. Dave, and he's a dentist who suspects that his dentist wife, Dana, is having a torrid affair. But he's so bottled up that he doesn't want to know. Not only does he not confront her, he goes to desperate lengths to keep her from blurting out the truth, because acknowledging it would mean he'd have to do something. The Age of Grief is a haunting interior monologue, but if someone had told me it would be gangbusters on screen under the title The Secret Lives of Dentists, I'd have thought they'd had too much nitrous oxide. And I'd have been wrong. The movie, which stars Campbell Scott and Hope Davis as the traumatized dentists, is terrific. It's buoyant, it's funny, and it jazzes up the Smiley novella without vulgarizing it. It's like Scenes from a Marriage if Ingmar Bergman had a sense of humor, or a Woody Allen movie if Allen could write with so much ruthless emotional precision. The screenwriter is the playwright Craig Lucas, and the director is Alan Rudolph. They have great chemistry. Rudolph makes Lucas seem less off-Broadway slick, and Lucas is a check on Rudolph's delusions of poetic grandeur. The setting is a three-ring circus of the psyche. Over in ring number one is the couple's joint dental practice, with its vacuous chatter during drilling, and its sinks of swirling blood. In the second ring sits their rambling colonial, with the three young daughters who flit in and out of the frame, each girl making different and distinctive demands. The third ring is Dave's fantasy life, which features an alter ego called Slater, played by Dennis Leary. Slater begins as a real patient, then turns into the macho devil perched on Dave's shoulder, his inner lout. Those sequences, which are less central in Smiley's novella, are a little broad, and Leary's wild man shtick isn't as fresh as everything else in the movie. Yet, Slater might be the key to the film's success. His raunchy vaudeville act with Dave takes a lot of pressure off the scenes between Dave and Dana, which can now be as oblique as Smiley conceived them. My favorite of the couple's exchanges comes early, after Dana has performed with her local choir in a Verdi opera. That's where she might have met her lover. And the day after the show closes, she sits in mourning at the breakfast table, talking of music, while Dave tries to warn her about his patient, Slater.
I just can't believe it's over, you know? It's so beautiful. I could sing it every night forever.
Well, you'll sing other things.
I don't want to sing other things.
I saw that Slater guy last night. His filling fell out.
Mine?
No. He's the one I told you about. Impacted upper and lower. One of them halfway up to his eyeball. Won't have them out till they hurt. Needs to see a periodontist anyway. If you get him, don't charge him. Okay?
It's a waltz. That's what's so tragic.
Uh-huh.
I mean, you could dance to it, but you can't.
It's devastating, that combination of Verdi and Dana's realization that her life is a waltz you can't dance to. The distance between Dave and Dana seems so vast in that moment, you wonder how they could ever have inhabited the same emotional universe. Hope Davis is gorgeous in that scene, and I love the way that Campbell Scott's Dr. Dave watches her, with maximum alertness and minimum comprehension. Scott has the morbid edge he honed in last year's Roger Dodger, with some of the self-effacing sweetness of Kyle MacLachlan. As an actor, he seems ready to break into the heavyweight class. But not everything in The Secret Lives of Dentists clicks. Dr. Dave's fever dreams of dental assistant Laura, played by the adorable Robin Tunney, as a vampy chanteuse, are just odd. And the long sequence in which the family is stricken with flu doesn't achieve the lucid delirium that the filmmakers must have intended. But even when the movie misses its marks, you can see what it's going for and be delighted by its loopy ambition. The music by Gary DeMichel gooses you past the rough spots. He uses some sort of electronic instrument to approximate the sound of a dentist drill. And at times, it seems to be keening while the filmmakers drill for fresh nerves.
David Edelstein is film critic for the online magazine Slate. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Phyllis Myers, Amy Sallet, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, and Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Ian Chillog. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shorrock directs the show. WHYY's executive producer of national radio programming is Elizabeth Perez Luna. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air are available at 1-877-213-7374 or on the internet at www.burrells.com. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, what it's like to ride a 1,200-pound thoroughbred at 45 miles an hour. We meet jockey Gary Stevens. He's won the Kentucky Derby three times and is a racing Hall of Famer. And he has a part in the new film Seabiscuit. I'm Barbara Bogave. Join us for the next Fresh Air.